Testing 1 2 3, testing 1 2 3. Look, we're just about to start before a few moments of sound check. If you can hear the sound okay, just type audio okay at the bottom of your screen. We'll just stop momentarily. That's a Fry D. Is the sound too low? We're just seeing that the sound is a little bit too low right now. The sound is okay, just type audio okay. And we'll start momentarily. Okay, Lenora, thank you. Elisheva, thank you. And again, once you hear the audio, if the audio sound is fine, just type audio okay at the bottom of your screen. That'll let us know that everybody's picking up the sound okay. And we'll just stop momentarily.
Hello.
Morning, Rabbi.
Hey, Doug, how are you?
Well, how are you?
Okay, doing well.
All right, we're going to have a show right here.
We won't penalize you for that.
So I was juggling getting a couple of concert films set up. Hang on just a second, and I should be able to treat away everybody else.
Okay, great. Okay, so everybody. Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay, and Rabbi, you're there. Let me get a phone on speaker. And Debbie, are you on yet? Okay. Pat, are you on? Don, are you on? But Sean, you're there? Got a couple that are still scheduled to connect in.
Okay, so maybe we'll give them another minute to start?
Yeah, if we could give them another minute to,
okay.
Sort it out, that'd be great.
Okay. All right, so we'll start the class in a few minutes, and we got a couple of people online also, so For those of you that are online, you can take a look at Isaiah chapter 1. We're going to do about the first 10 verses, first 10 psukim. Okay, give me 1 minute.
Okay.
Okay, we'll start in 1 minute, exactly. Okay. All right, so let's start. All right, so let's read a bit. Just get a little background. Since we're dealing with Isaiah, he basically lived the years 740 to 681 BCE. You're going back about 570 years after we got the Torah at Har Sinai. So after the Torah was received, Isaiah lived about 570 years after that, and that was also coincided a little bit over 200 years after Solomon built the temple. So he's living during the first temple period in Jerusalem, and the first we can start with a question, being that Isaiah is a prophet. What is the necessity in Judaism for prophets? So I'll put that as a question to you to start. What do you think the necessity is in Judaism for prophets?
Rabbi, isn't the necessity to either bring additional clarity to the Torah itself or to bring a message to the people about what they should be doing?
Yes, he's definitely going to be bringing that, but even though he's bringing clarity, or a message to the people. So what about the concept that God gave us a complete Torah system, not to add, not to subtract? We have a complete system. So why can't we suggest that we have everything necessary in the Torah itself without the need for a prophet?
That's a very good question.
I was thinking it's hard for people to grasp the abstract there. That's because we're in a physical world, we're attached more to physical things, and so we can relate better to those who, I guess, either set examples for us or can give us guidance.
All right.
Not that directly.
But then you wouldn't need necessarily a prophet. Set example. You're saying if you need people to set examples or give you guidance, that you can have from a person, your next door neighbor who's living properly according to the Torah.
That's true. Rabbi, could it be that normally, in a Torah society, you've got the Torah and the rabbis are like coaches to guide us along, but every once in a while, if the patient gets sick enough, you need a doctor to come in and with, I guess, what we might call extraordinary knowledge to diagnose and prescribe, and that function of a problem.
So when people go too much off the path, you're saying, which would be analogous to a person getting very sick.
Right.
Well, I guess you looked at a couple of the verses ahead where it actually it analogizes the sin of the Jews to a body that's completely plagued. Did you see that further on in the...
Well, only in 1 through 10. I don't think I saw it further down.
Yeah, in... right, exactly. It's verse 6.
Yeah.
Right. Right, well, I would agree with you that the necessity is going to be to get the people that are veering off the path, back on. Of course, that's exactly what the prophet is doing. Let's see if we can take a look here. Actually, we started going through the verses a bit. It starts off with saying that this is the vision of Yeshayahu, the son of Amoz, that he saw regarding Judah and Jerusalem. The Jews were split to two locations. In the days of Uzziahu, and Yosam, and Ahaz, and Chizkiyahu, four different kings. Malchihut, these were the kings of the Jews at that time. He goes on and he starts talking. He says, listen, heavens, Shimu Shemayim, listen, heavens, and give ear the land, because God speaks. Children I have made great, and I raised them up, but they sinned against me. And now verse 3, the ox knows it's the one that acquired him, and a donkey knows the crib of its owner, where it eats, the commentaries say. But Israel doesn't know, and my people don't even ponder. They don't even consider. He says, "Whoa!" That'd be, I guess, translated like, "Alas, a nation that sins, a people that is laden with sin, a seed of evildoers, children that are destructive. They forsook God, and they provoked the Holy One of Israel." And they've turned backwards. Very, very lengthy description as to what the problem was. So he is now coming in to set the people straight. And just to get back to the point I was asking, what is the need for prophet? There is a there are always basic themes, and the words of the prophet are very. I mean, these are basically inspired by God. So when we learn this, we have to study this, really with a fine tooth comb, and try to really appreciate every nuance as much as we possibly can. If time is limited, and our capacity is limited. So, but we definitely, if we have the appreciation, like Mir Pirkei Avos, like Ethics of the Father says, that if you turn it and keep on turning it, meaning the Torah, if you keep on turning it over and examining it, you'll find things because everything is there. Everything is in it. It doesn't mean, like some people think, that if you look in the Torah, you'll be able to find out how to tune a V8 engine. We don't go that extreme. Well, there are people that have like an infantile approach, and they think everything's in the Torah. Well, every single thing and possibly imaginable. But the Torah is not anything except to give us guidance in terms of our philosophical and our moral life. It also has, benefits in terms of what's good for us physically. Like, for example, Shabbos, having rest is necessary, so that's part of the Torah. But in terms of going any further, how to get the best color red paint for a new car, that's not going to be something you find in the Torah. So it's going to give you all the information necessary in terms of living your proper life, in terms of approaching God. Anything which is extraneous to approaching God is not going to be encased in the Torah. So we don't say when everything is in the Torah, that every single, science and technological advancement is there. Now, when the prophet comes, we have the concept here that he is now admonishing the people. Again, I originally asked, well, what's the necessity of the prophet if you have the complete Torah system already? So, Doug, you mentioned that he's going to direct the people once they get sick, and that's exactly what the words say. If we go further on, he says that where, in the next verse, which is up to 5, where can you be smitten further? You continue in turning aside. Every head is sick, and every heart is faint. From the top of your head, from the bottom of your foot, mikaf, from the heel of your foot, this is 6 now, verse 6, and up to the top of your head. Ein bom musom, the misom, there's no perfection. You are not complete. Meaning the body's completely covered over. Petzev, chabura, umaka, tria. There's all different types of wounds that your body has. All right.
Rabbi?
Yes.
We take that literally, or is that a spiritual...
Well, this is, I think, is complying with your idea that they aren't smitten physically here. The commentaries say that when it says that you have all these different plagues and you haven't been bandaged and you haven't put, that's what says, lo chubashu, and v'lo rukacha b'shem, and you haven't emolliated yourself with oil, you haven't tried to heal yourself with oil, meaning that it's a euphemistically talking about the sickness of the sin, how far the Jews have gone with their sin.
Okay.
It doesn't mean, and I think this is actually Yonason, I think it means Yonason ben Uziel, who gives this explanation. And it makes sense to me, because you don't need the prophet to come and tell you about physical ailments. What they want to do is show how far gone, and speak in the terms at least that the people understand, because if they're sinning, that means they don't look at sin as such a tragic thing. But physical ailments, that's for sure. I always use the analogy when people want to pick and choose about following the Torah. So the analogy you give them, well, when you go to a doctor and he tells you, take these 10 pills, here's the times of the day you should take them, don't take 9, don't take 11, and take them in this order. So a person would be foolish to say, well, no, I'm just going to take 8 and I'll do them what I want. Because the doctor's saying your life is based, your survival is based on taking this medication in the right prescription. So the person would not risk their life. However, a person doesn't realize that their life is temporary. The physical life is temporary, whereas their spiritual life is something which they should place even more importance on. So what he does is he speaks in the language of the people, because this is what they value, and tries to drive them back to what's correct. Okay, now, further he goes on and starts speaking about the land, but let's backtrack a bit now. Let's try to take a look at what, what exactly he is saying here. There's a lot that's going on. So the first verse, again, describes that it's Isaiah, son of Amoz. And there's a vision that he saw regarding Jerusalem and Judah in the days of Uzziah, Yotam, Ahaz, and Chizkiah, the kings of Judah. Now he starts delivering his message. He says, listen, heavens, and give ear, the land. Okay, we have to look at this verse very carefully. Listen, heavens, and give ear to the land. For God speaks, children I have made great and raised them up, but they sinned against me. Okay. Now, what are the elements of this verse? When studying any verse, we have to look at the entire verse. We looked at the context a bit right now. That's very important to do. But now once we get a feel for the context, we go back to each individual verse and see what the contents are of each verse. And then we have to see the sequence of the verses to understand how the next verse follows on the heels of the one that preceded it. So what would we say the elements are of this verse?
Can I back up and ask a question on the first verse?
Go ahead.
It says the vision of Isaiah, which vision, according to my translation, is in the singular. And yet it says in the days of these four kings. Now the days of those four kings spanned a period over 100 years.
Right.
I would think that a vision is like a prophetic dream and it happens and you get it. So it would be like on a particular day or something. So I'm a little bit confused as to why it says the vision of Isaiah in the days of all four kings. Is that he had this vision constantly during that time, or that he got it once, but it's intended to apply that whole time. I'm just a little confused by the mention of the days of all four of those kings.
That's a good question. I don't have an answer to that. I don't know.
Okay.
I didn't know.
Okay.
I mean, you could say that it was a vision that applied to the nation during those four kings.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not sure if when you get a vision, do you only say it once, or do you constantly, you know, tell the people until you try to get them back on the track? I'm not sure if the vision is, if people ask you questions, you can't just stop talking. You say a vision once, and then people months later hear about it, it finally gets to their town. But they didn't have email back then, so there was no way of, like, instant communication. So however long it took, people would spread the word, and then they may see him in another town, they would ask him. I'm sure that he would re-deliver, you know, based on the people he would listen to, just like Avram would teach people based on their own level. And he had one basic message about monotheism, but it had to be expressed in different ways. But your question's a good one.
So you're looking for the part of verse 2.
Yes. What are the elements over here?
Well, he's got the initial, it's opening with who he's addressing, which is the heavens and the earth. And then he's setting up that he's going to say something that Hashem has said.
All right.
Your attention with that. And then best I can tell, quote in the next, in the latter part of 2 and all of 3, quote what Hashem has told me.
Okay, what would the separate elements be, though?
I guess I'm not sure what you mean by elements.
How would you separate the verse? And how many parts would you say are in the verse?
I'd say three parts. I'd say who he's addressing. Here, heavens and earth. And then he says the second part would be who he's telling has spoken, which is God. And then the third part is what God said.
Well, no, when he speaks, he's actually delivering the whole message. So the words here he's giving, so those words that he's giving right now are the words from God from the beginning, where he says, listen.
Okay, then I'd probably break it further, because he says, hear, O heaven. So that seems to be one thing. And then give ear, O earth. There must be a reason that he's said both of those. In other words, he didn't just say, listen up, everybody. He's made a distinction between those. And then there's the, well, if it's all what God is saying, then he's giving attribution, for Hashem has spoken. And then he's got, I've raised children and exalted them, and then, but, you know, here's what I did, but then here's what actually happened, the result, they've rebelled against me.
Okay, well, let me ask you, what do you think the concept is when he first says, listen, heavens and earth? I mean, that seems to be, that strikes me as being very odd.
I think it does us too, because why doesn't he address it to the people? Why is he speaking to the heavens, and why is he speaking to the earth?
Well, he's not speaking to the heavens. The heavens can't hear, the earth can't hear.
Right.
So he's not speaking to them. So now you got to take that information and reevaluate what exactly he's doing. The next thing he says is that, for God speaks. And then the next thing he says, children I have made great and raised them, but they sinned. To me, there's three parts to the verse. First, he says, listen, heaven and earth. Then he says, for God speaks. And then he says, I've made my children great, and high, but they sinned. All right, so that would be what, you know, my categorization of how, you know, to separate the verse. So the first question is, what is he talking about heaven and earth? What is that doing here? What's the message? What comes to mind when we talk about heaven and earth?
Somewhere else where heaven and earth are called as witnesses. And I want to say maybe it's Moses saying something, I call heaven and earth as witnesses.
Yes. Actually, Warren, who's joining us also, said the same thing. He's commissioned the witnesses. And what does it mean that the heaven and earth are witnesses, though? In what respect are they witnesses? What is the purpose of a witness? What does a witness do?
Just give testimony as to what they have seen and heard.
Okay. So if the witnesses give testimony of what they've seen and heard about something, what exactly did a heaven and earth testify to?
Well, in this case, they could probably testify to the actions of Israel or the state of Israel.
No, I think when I suggest the possibility, you'll see why. I can't really, because again, keep in mind that heaven and earth are inanimate things, so they are not going to, you know, they are not witnessing any specific events.
How about they testify by their existence to God's creation and His infinite complexity?
Exactly. Perfect. Heaven and earth encompass all of physical creation, so they testify, their existence testifies to their being a creator. So the first thing that Yeshaya, that Isaiah is saying, is wake up, Jews, and recognize that there is a heaven and earth. What does that mean? That means that there had to be a creator. Right? So the first thing he's trying to do is get people back on track in terms of recognizing the creator. Evidently, their attention is focused on something else. Okay? So that makes sense in terms of what a witness is. Okay? All right. So, that's the first thing. That's the heaven and earth. And that, if we have to define heaven and earth, that always calls to mind creation. Where the first, the opening of the Torah, in the beginning God created heaven and earth. All right, so when he says give ear, he's saying we should give ear. Shemu, listen. Shemayim v'hazino arts. So he's sort of personifying things which are inanimate. But he's now saying this in front of the people, that they should think to themselves, what's significant about heaven and earth? Then he says, Ki Hashem Dibur, for God speaks. So now he's telling them that there's a message coming from the Creator. Don't think that the heaven and earth was a one-time creation like Aristotle, and then God... Well, actually, he doesn't say that God created it, but that God is not involved. That's not true. God is very involved. God speaks. There's a message. There's communication from the Creator. So he calls to mind that there is a Creator, and then he says that there is a communication, that God is governing. And I think the next two, I'll ask you another question. What does it mean that children I have made great and I have raised them? What's the difference between making the children, he's talking about the Jews, making them great, and I have raised them. What are those two concepts?
I would think that making them great is the numbers, that he's allowed them to multiply and become great in number.
Okay. What's another type of greatness?
To raise them up in maybe providing them with all they need to be leaders. To be great is to be a leader, recognized as a leader.
Right, so how did God make the Jews great as opposed to other people?
Great in stature among the nations because of their because of the fact that they've been able to conquer other people.
Plus, he gave them the Torah.
The Torah, there you go. That's the mark.
Yeah.
And the conquering is only on the heels of that, only because if they live properly, then they'll be able to conquer and be able to, for the goal of having, you know, retaining the status of leadership. And but that's not the end in itself. Leadership is not the end. It's only a means by which other peoples can come to the Jew and hear what he has to say and join in. Because God, you know, initially God did not make Jew and non-Jew. God made Adam and Eve. He made man and woman. It was only because of so many thousands of years of sin that eventually the Torah was necessary. And it was given. God didn't give a Torah to Adam and Eve. He didn't give it to Noah. He gave seven commands. That was it. The goal was really for man to use his intelligence and to arrive at truths. But when there was so much corruption, so the Torah came. And you see the Torah addresses so much of what nations had sinned with. Had those nations never existed, you couldn't have a law in the Torah. Don't be like the Egyptians if there were no such thing as the Egyptians. So you couldn't have a law about don't follow the ways of the Amorite if there was never an Amorite nation. So the Torah is coming to correct mistakes. But initially, the plan was to have just a few commands, and that all peoples would follow as one. But it wasn't until you had the corruption of idolatry, and then the individual like Abraham, who was able to extricate himself from an idolatrous life and realize on his own that monotheism is true and idolatry is false and paganism is false. And it's my opinion that this is exactly why God selected Avram to be a leader, was because he, without any teacher, as Maimonides says, was able to use his own mind and his mind alone to prove to himself what the truths are in existence. He raised his intelligence to such a high point that God started to speak to him. God doesn't speak to any person. You have to be in a tremendously high level. So God sets up Abraham as an example that you can, using your mind alone, remove all the false ideas about idolatry in the world and arrive at truths. So you see that the intellect of a person is very capable in and of itself. But there's few Abrahams, and maybe due to the corrupt level of society, which we saw once had to be wiped out with a flood, and the second time it was could be salvaged by giving a Torah, giving a system by which people get back on the track. Otherwise, more and more people would be lost to idolatry. So he sets up Abraham, who is of the same ilk as everybody else in the world at the time, because he demonstrated how, using mind alone, you can reach truth. God didn't just put Adam and Eve and everybody up to the time of Moses, you know, without a Torah and just, you know, it's a free-for-all. No, they have, the human being has the capability to be an independently functioning being to arrive at truths. So now that God selected Abraham, he selected, you know, Abraham to be the leader, but not that now this people should have the good and nobody else should have it. He set him up and his children in order to help the rest of the world get back on the path. It's a mistake, and it's a lot of it's a foolish arrogance that many, many Jews have, that they feel that they're better, or that this I hear also this nonsense that there's something better about a Jewish soul. I mean, it's ridiculous, because we have the same soul that God gave to Adam and Eve and to Noah. So there's no difference. There's just a different role that the Jew has to play. And, you know, first and foremost, it has to be a humble one. It has to be based on truth, not based on trying to, exalt oneself in front of others. But that seems to be exactly what the sin is that you see Isaiah will get into here. Because he talks later on about God is rebuking the Jews about, do I need your sacrifices and all your holidays? I don't want any of your prayers. I don't want any of your sacrifices. What do I want? Judge the orphan and the widow and plead for the widow and, you know, to be righteous and not to try to seek gain. Because what happened was that these people at this time were looking for unjust gain and taking bribes. And even the leaders were doing this. So you see that the ego is a very, very devilish ally. It is an ally because God gave us the ego for a reason, but it could be used just for pure subjective gain and to put down other people. So now he's speaking. He's saying that you diverted your attention from God. So that's why he starts off by saying, Shimu Shemayim Vezin Arts, listen to heavens and earth, calling the people back to the concept that there's a creator and that you have a different focus right now, which is not good. Okay. Then he says God speaks. Now there's a communication. Now, again, going back to the question of children I have made great and I have raised, I think there's two things here in terms of made great and raised. Great means that he gave the system. He made them, he gave them the system of the Torah, like you said, Cal. Romamti is in terms of, normally it means position, a higher position in, you know, physically higher, elevated. It also means elevated in terms of status when compared to others. And the commentaries say that he raised the Jews higher than the others in order that they should be the educators. But this all harkens back to the fact that he gave a Torah. So this is really where the greatness comes from. So he gives the Jews a Torah, but why does he mention that over here? And the last part of the verse is, but they sinned against me. Now take those two things and tell me what the message is. Again, he says, children I have made great and I have elevated them, but they sinned against me. What is his message here?
Rabbi, can I just clarify that then the meaning of the raise them is to be greater so that they can be teachers?
Yes.
Okay.
It's not just for ourselves. It's not only because we see that two parshas ago in the Torah we read on Shabbos, it says that God says, am I going to keep hidden from Avram what I'm going to do to Sodom and Amorah? And Abram's going to be a great and mighty nation. He's going to teach his household afterwards and command them in the ways of God to do righteousness and charity. So God is saying this as a narrative, sort of speak, you know, a comment without anybody listening. But he's saying this in the Torah to instruct us, why is he now going to divulge to Abraham what's going to happen to Sodom and Amorah? He wants to engage Abraham in discussion about justice because Abraham is going to be a teacher. So when if I'm not mistaken, I think that the Talmud talks about that if a person learns to teach, he's given, greater knowledge. Meaning he's conforming himself to the will of God, so God will assist in that progress, as opposed to if he's just learning to have his own enjoyment in study, which is a very good level. But if he learns to teach, he's given both the ability to learn and the ability to teach. So this is what God was doing with Abraham, because Abraham was somebody who risked everything to teach others. That's how far his concern was for his fellow men. He really had compassion. Now when God says over here that I've made my children great and I've raised them, so that means he's given us, what was the greatness? The greatness was giving us a system to approach him. But he says, v'heim pashubi. So what was the sin? The sin was that they went against the very plan that God gave. That's what it means, pashubi, they sinned against me. I mean, can't you say that every sin in the Torah is a sin against God? Why is he used the terminology over here? So like we said, the fact that they went against their proper mission, and they started going after their own greedy gain. So this is one of the big sins of the Jews at this time. So what you really should have looked at is that I gave you something great, but there was a purpose behind this. I went ahead and I made you great and I elevated you, but you sinned against me. You didn't recognize what I gave you. So right at the beginning of his rebuke, he dives right in and makes them realize that they should have, you know, cognizance of a creator. So he talks about heavens and earth and that God is now communicating to us now. So he says, because God speaks. It's not just that he created the world and left it. He's involved. And that's also alluded to in the fact that Gidalti Viramamti, that I made you great and I elevated you. That means that God is involved in our current state. On as the years go by, God's not absent. He did something at a certain point in time. He gave us the Torah. He's governing. He's not just a creator, but he's a governor. A governor means that he's involved in the daily affairs of his creatures. No, but the Jews didn't look at all of this. The fact that he's a creator and he's governing, he's taking interest in us on a regular basis, but we are just going after our own subjective desires. So this is what he's trying to bring to their attention right at the beginning. Okay, so let me pause here and see if there's any questions.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Just wondering, when you talked about, in the very beginning, your first question about a prophet and why have prophets, it made me wonder if God gave visions to other people, but they don't act as a prophet until they take that vision out and do something with it. Like, you know, maybe other people received visions too, but they just thought, I had a nice dream or something and didn't do anything with it. See what I'm saying?
No, I'm not clear. Say it again.
We only read about prophets who had a vision that did something with it, and I wonder if God gave vision to other people, but they didn't do anything with it. I mean, I suppose we have no way of knowing, but I just wondered if a true prophet is one that gets the vision and then, you know, relates what it is that God wants them to relate.
It could be. It could be that God gives a vision to somebody and for themselves. I don't know. I mean, it's a very large area of study, and that's not something which I know much about, how it works and when he gives it, but the fact that God wants the best for a human being, I mean, you see that a certain individual in Genesis, he had killed him before his time so he wouldn't fall prey to the negative influences in his area,
right.
So in order that he'd be saved as a righteous individual, so God intervened for one person, for himself, so I would agree that a person could get a prophecy that would be for himself as well, unless there's a principle in prophecy that it only has to do with exhorting other people as well. So I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think the reason I got that is because if you look at God gave the nation this information, and they used it in a manner that God didn't want them to, it seems to me that if you take it to an individual level, that might also be true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. There's nothing which opposes it in terms of, Torah ideals.
Yeah. I guess I looked at it as just an aside.
Yeah, but it's to study the Rebbe Chaim once given a class about a year or two ago, how the patriarchs and the matriarchs would be studying at the yeshiva. They had a place, I think it was the Shem. So that was the son of Noach,
mm-hmm.
And they would study there the how God's providence works. Because the studying of the Ashkacha, the providence, is a very great study, and that's what Jacob was doing for 14 years en route to Laban. So it's a very big study about how the actual, you know, God's ways. I mean, we can't figure out how the Big Bang occurred. And that's a physical. That's at least something, like Freud said when he first, he was giving a lecture once, and he said that he knows that he's going to be open to attack, because if he was lecturing on biology or, you know, anatomy, so he'd be able to show a cadaver. He had some tangible evidence to support his theories. But since he was lecturing on psychology, which is something abstract, it was more open to being shot down. So with the physical world, at least we have things that we can study. When we're talking about God's providence, it's purely in the area of how God operates. So it's a tremendous study. We, you know, whatever we can gain, we should feel very fortunate about. Okay, let's go to the next verse, verse 3. Interesting verse. It says that a ox knows its owner, and a donkey knows the crib of its master. But Israel does not know, and my people do not ponder. Okay, let's pause for a minute and see exactly what is his message here now. Let's take a couple of minutes and think about what the message is. And again, for just to know you are, we're in Isaiah chapter 1, verse 3. So if anybody has a text, they want to take a look at it.
Rabbi?
Yes. Yes, Doug?
Yeah. Well, an ox knows its owner, seems like he is saying, look, a beast of the field knows who owns it or who its master is, and I would presume he's making the contrast, well, in fact, he is by virtue of the last part of the verse, saying a simple beast of the field knows who its owner is, but Israel doesn't seem to recognize that I'm its owner. And similarly, a donkey knows his master's trough, knows where his food comes from, knows where to go to get it, yet Israel doesn't realize that I'm providing everything for it.
Okay, so what's his message?
I'm sorry?
So what is the underlying message? That's true, those are the facts. But I'm not going to let you off so easy, Doug.
Okay, that's all right. So it's almost like he's asking the question, if a simple beast knows this, why don't you understand it?
Right. So what's his objective by making a statement like this?
To bring them around to see that it should be so obvious to them, there shouldn't be any question about it.
All right, so what is he playing on?
He's playing on their, I guess, perhaps their pride?
Yeah. I would say so, because the real problem here, if, you know, again, we had to go look forward a bit and see, but they were after their own subjective gain. The me was the most important thing. And putting down other people and not, you know, and stealing and, taking advantage of those that, you know, can't speak for themselves because the person's an orphan or a widow. Right, so people like that is a very easy target. That's why the Torah says that if you oppress the orphan or the widow, so then I will kill you and make your children the orphans and your wife the widow. Meaning to say that there is some sort of a proclivity to attacking these type of individuals. What is the reason? Why does a person want to not attack anybody, but he'll go after an orphan and a widow? You think it'd be just the opposite. You know, a person with good morals would be sensitive to these people.
They're weak and can't defend themselves?
Right. They're an easy mark. Exactly. They're an easy mark. So now I could elevate myself in with somebody who's not going to be able to fight back. So the self is the important thing. So if that's where they were coming from, perhaps what Isaiah was doing was trying to play on that very emotion. And I'll give you another example. But again, here, he's saying these dumb animals, at least, know, quote-unquote, their masters. But you don't, and you don't even ponder. Israel does not know, and they don't even ponder. Two things. So he's trying to get them where they live. They're going after a lifestyle where they are the center of the universe. So he hits them right there and says, if you're such a center of the universe, how come a dumb animal is smarter than you? That's something which a person won't want to hear. And hopefully that'll hit them emotionally. There was a case in, not a case, but a lesson in Mishlei, where a person who was lazy. So King Solomon says about the person that, you know, actually it was a procrastinator. That was the specific type of personality that King Solomon was addressing. And he says, what do you want to do? A little folding of your hands, a little lying down, a little slumber. That's why he was using sarcasm. He was saying to the person who's a procrastinator that, because a person procrastinates, why does a person procrastinate? What's the idea behind procrastination? So certain people just don't do anything. They're lazy and that's it. And certain people are very energetic and they accomplish things in life. But then there's a person who's in the middle. He doesn't want to have the reputation that he's a lazy, no good for nothing. So he tells people, I'll do it later. So now he gets best of both worlds. At least he thinks. On the one hand, what does he do? He gets the reputation that he's going to accomplish things in life. He's a doer. But he gets off the hook by saying, I'm doing it, but later. But later never comes. So King Solomon, being one of the wisest men, and we're told that Mashiach, that Messiah, is going to be smarter than Solomon and close to Moses in prophecy. So that's a real praise if a person is going to be smarter than Solomon. So, but King Solomon is saying that if you're a procrastinator and you're trying to push off later, so what is the real motivating force in the procrastinator to tell others that I'm going to do it later? You tell me. Why does a procrastinator tell others, I will do this later?
In order to get credit for the idea that they will do it, but to basically avoid having to tackle it?
Right, exactly. I would just take the word credit and just change it to the word approval.
Okay.
So the procrastinator is looking for social approval. He's still living in the world of the psychological. He lives based on what's important in terms of my self-image. So I can't, you know, I'd rather not do anything because I'm lazy. But, you know, what are people going to think of me? So let me tell them I'll do it, but I'll do it later. So this way I get the approval, I get the accolades of my peers, but yet I don't have to do anything and I could sit back and drink my beer. So King Solomon understands what the motivating force is in the procrastinator. So what is his response? He goes, yeah, sure you're going to do it. What he's doing, what is King Solomon now doing when he uses sarcasm to the procrastinator and he says, yeah, sure you're going to do it? What is
unmasking the underlying motive.
Yeah. What do you mean?
Well, the procrastinator is kind of playing a game. And King Solomon is sort of taking away the smoke screen and showing him for what he really is.
Right, and what is that? What is he doing that for? Why is King
psychologically
Solomon?
To push the procrastinator to sort of get real.
Yeah, and how does that do that? How does it push the procrastinator to get real and act? I agree with you 100%. Is this one last?
Yeah,
step?
I'm.
Is it kind of a challenge, like put up or shut up?
Yes, exactly. Meaning what he's doing is, but think psychologically. I don't want to give it away. Think psychologically exactly what exactly is going to go on now in the head of the procrastinator and what the mechanism King Solomon employed here.
Well, if the procrastinator is unmasked, then he would have to be thinking, whoops, I've been found out, and now if I try to use my procrastinating technique, it's not going to work because everybody knows I'm fooling them. Therefore, if I really want the approval, I'm going to have to deliver.
Exactly. Perfect. Exactly. Since he's going after the approval of others, so that's exactly what King Solomon does. I taking away my approval? Because Solomon's words are always to try to get a person back onto the right life. So in the area of procrastination, there's a certain method psychologically to do it. And he had a very keen sense of psychology. He knew exactly which buttons to push. He did this again in another case, the famous story. As soon as he was given wisdom, when he was 12 years old, and God came to him in a vision and asked, "What shall I give you?" Sha'al me'eten lach, God says to King Solomon. So Solomon evidently would not have asked, again, being 12 years old, but still being wise, when King David died, and he took over the throne. So this is actually Cal regarding Haftorah. This is what happened in yesterday's Haftorah, if you want to take a look. So it talks about this very event. So what happened was that after he became king, God asked him, "Ask what I shall give you." So he thought for a second, and he says, "Why is God?" And this is just I'm just filling in the blanks here, but why would God be asking me for this? I mean, he gave us, you know, autonomy to live our life with our own, you know, abilities. It must be that God is introducing me to something which normally I cannot ask for. So God's now giving me an opening to gain something which naturally is unattainable. So he realized that must be knowledge. Because knowledge normally just takes toil and trouble, and you have to take the time to do it. But it's not something you just get immediately. But since he now became the king, and he wanted to be able to judge the people properly, so he asked for knowledge to judge the people. And God gave it to him. Miraculously, overnight, he became extremely wise. And soon thereafter, two harlots had there was an encounter where they were both, I guess, sleeping in the same room, and they both had infants. And one harlot had rolled over on her baby and suffocated it. And it was the middle of the night, and she realized this, so she swapped babies with the other woman, whose baby was, of course, still alive, because she was taking care of it. In the morning, the mother of, you know, the live baby looks at her baby, sees it's dead, but then recognizes this is not her baby. So they come before King Solomon, and they make a claim. And one woman says, you know, they tell her what happened, and the woman who was, you know, the careful woman, said, "The live baby is mine, and the dead one is hers." Then the woman who was careless says, "No, the dead baby is hers, and the live one is mine." And if you look at the story, you'll see what happened was, is that the order is reversed in terms of what each woman says. The careful woman says, "The live baby is mine, and the dead one is hers." Then the other woman, the careless woman, says, "The dead one is hers." She talks about hers first, right? She says, "The dead one is hers, and the live one is mine." So then King Solomon says, and it's recorded in the prophets. It's amazing. It records what he was thinking to himself. You rarely have this. And he says, "This one says, the live one is mine, and the dead one is hers. And this one says, the dead one is hers, and the live one is mine." So the commentators say on the spot, at least one does, that a woman's proclivity is to speak about her own child first. So the woman who rightfully had the live baby, she said the live one is mine, talking about hers first, and the dead one is hers. But the liar said the dead one is hers, because still she's speaking about her own child first. It's just a natural impulse that the woman's going to talk about her own first. And Solomon knew this. King Solomon knew this. So, but he also knew that if he just made a judgment based on what took place in his court, the rest of the people were not keen enough to appreciate his judgment. They wouldn't have attributed to him any wisdom, and they would have said, "What are you doing? How can you give the baby to this one?" They both said the same thing. So he had to come up with a plan. What was his plan? His plan was, "Give me the baby, we'll cut it in half, and neither one will have it." Now you tell me, what was his plan? And I bring this up because it has to do with the same method that he used in terms of the procrastinator. Now keep in mind, if you were King Solomon and you heard that you had this in the court, and there were people all around you in the court, and you hear, you know, the whole court is listening, and the first woman comes up and says, "The live one is mine, the dead one is hers." Next woman comes up and says, "The dead one is hers, the live one is mine." It sounds like an identical statement from both people.
But not to a person who knows psychology.
And it could determine the truth just based on that alone. But in order that his word is received properly by the people, he has to do something which everybody's going to appreciate.
So he says we're going to divide the baby in half, which sounds it is barbaric. But what was his
deep insight? And again, this is right after
God gave him the amazing amount of wisdom overnight.
Rabbi, I want to suggest that he realized that the motivation of the woman whose child had died, who was careless, was that she did not want the other woman to be able to have a child while she had lost hers. And that therefore, by setting up the I'll divide it in half test, it would bring out that her motivation was not that she should be able to keep the live child, but that neither one of them should be able to have a child.
Good. So
and that the mother that had the live child would do anything to keep her child alive.
Right.
And not having it.
Right, excellent.
Exactly. What he needed to do was to, again, just like with the procrastinator, expose what the underlying motive is, and get the person to move. But here it's not what he wants to do as well is to expose to everybody in the court what the true feelings were in each person. Because on the surface, it sounds like the same thing. So then he was able to bring out to the fore the callous nature of the liar, the lying woman, and the careful nature of the true mother.
So when the people saw that, they were astonished. That he was able to, he wasn't astonished so much that the right woman got it, or so on, but that his plan, he thought about a plan that actually achieved this type of a response.
So it's exactly what he was doing, was bringing out to the fore the actual motivation. So this way, when he makes the judgment, it's clear that he did the right thing.
So you see that he had the insight, and that's why it records his words. It records his words to show you that he knew already who the true mother was. But the people in the court would have received it because the complaints of both, the litigants were, seemingly identical.
So that, again, parallels what he was doing here with the procrastinator. So now bringing it back and applying it to Isaiah, again, the prophet has an extreme amount of wisdom and understands where the flaws of the people are, and what he wants to do is motivate them back to the correct life. So if the flaw that the people have here is an absorption with the self and unjust gain and taking bribes means that I am going to distort justice so I come out ahead. The bottom line is how much do I have in my pocket? And not in terms of truth or fairness to other people. So since the self was the issue, it could very well be that this is what Isaiah was doing by making a statement, like you had alluded to, Doug, that it's showing how even the dumb animals have something which supersedes your abilities, you foolish Jews. They know these things, but does Israel know? No. Yisrael lo yada. Israel does not know. My people do not ponder. Again, he brings in my people. He doesn't just say Israel, but he talks about two references to the Jews. Each one of these verses is tremendous. I'm sure you've with Rabbi Moskowitz, you've come to learn over the years that the verses are, since they're divinely inspired, and it's not just a man speaking, but it's through some level of prophetic communication that the words are written down. So there's a tremendous amount to be taken out. I remember once listening to a class by Rabbi Chait, and it changed my entire way of learning. This is just a few years ago, and I'm glad I heard it. He made one statement, and he said that if you realize that every single thing in the world is, he says everything in the world is a reflection of God's wisdom, whether it's a color red or the shape of a stop sign or whatever it is all a reflection of God's wisdom, because shape is something which God designed. Color is something which is a creation of God.
And when I heard him say that, the next time I started looking at Rashi, which, you know, something you learn in the first grade, you know, when you're a kid, and you carry this very simplistic view of Rashi through your adulthood if, you know, if you're not careful with your learning. But once I heard Rabbi Chait said this, then I started applying, well, you know, the sages, the greatest leaders of Torah, you know, Rashi is up there, one of the greatest leaders. So now when I went back and I started looking at Rashi again, you know, the few words that he gives on this verse, or the few words he comments on that verse, I started to see an entire new world of knowledge just because I asked myself, what is really bothering him? What is he, what's the issue that is disturbing him that he had to use some ink on this verse? There must be something here because, again, he was looking at the world the same way Rabbi Chait had stated, that everything is a reflection of God's wisdom. So when he was studying the verses, there must have been something very deep that disturbed him. And using that, I started to see a tremendous amount more in each one of the verses. Somebody had a question this week about the death of Aaron, Moses' brother. In two places in the Torah, it says that he died on Mount Hor. And in one place, it says he died in Moserah, which was eight camps earlier. Two divergent locations on the globe. How could the Torah say that he died in Mount Hor, and also that he died in Moserah? So I went through Rashi on there, and to make a long story short, he gives allusions to what Moses was doing. Moses, at this point in Deuteronomy, was rebuking the Jews about a number of things. This is the end of his life, and this is the time to rebuke, where people will receive his rebuke. And in his discussion about the breaking of the tablets, he then says that you went back to Moserah, and Aaron died there. So Rashi on the spot says, what does Aaron's death have to do with this whole discussion about the breaking of the tablets? So Rashi says that it's an equation, that it is as difficult before God the day that Moses broke the tablets as the death of the righteous. Now, it's not difficult to God. God doesn't have any emotional problems. He has no emotions. But it must mean there's something which goes against his mission. The breaking of the tablets went against God's plan. Moses was right to break them, but the plan was that they should have the tablets and study them. But here, Moses had to break them. You know, perhaps they would bow down to them, just like they bowed down to the golden calf. That was what Rabbi Chait explained years ago. So he rightfully broke them. And God endorsed his action. But what does it mean, the death of the righteous? See, Aaron's death was premature due to the fact that he and Moses had, they forewent sanctifying God's name, and God said you should talk to the rock and water will come out, but they hit the rock. So they lost the ability to lead the Jews into Israel. So this was also against God's will. But he wants to say also that they're going back at this point. What does Moses do by putting in the story of the Jews traveling back to Moserah, right in the middle of a discussion of the breaking of the tablets, which is at Sinai, eight camps later? So he wants to say that this was just as bad as the bowing down to the calf. Going back to Moserah was just as destructive as bowing down to the calf, because the reasoning they went back to Moserah was after Aaron died, they felt that they weak and they couldn't fight the king of Ard. So they went backwards. They said, let's put a leader up and we'll go back to Egypt. Why all of a sudden did the Jews want to go back to Egypt? And this is not the first time they wanted to go back to Egypt. But going back to Egypt means that there's a certain affinity they still held in their hearts for that lifestyle. And what was the lifestyle of Egypt? That was the whole origin of animal worship. So if they are now backtracking, and they went back to Moserah after Aaron's death, so that's really a allusion to the fact that they are going back and they're reverting to their the disposition to be involved in idolatry. That's what it means, that going back to Moserah is akin to idol worship, to the golden calf, because it's really going back to the origins of the golden calf. Now we understand why Moses put this in the rebuke. When he's talking about the breaking of the tablets, he also talks about that Aaron died in Moserah, but he didn't die there. But he does that in order to suggest a hint to the Jews And it makes them think, wait a minute, Aaron didn't die on Moserah. But Moses puts a contradiction in the Torah, and his words is, yeah, I know he didn't die there. But it's as if he died in Moserah, he's trying to say. Meaning, the reason you got back to Moserah, why did you go back to Moserah? Why did you backtrack? Because after Aaron's death, you felt weak, whatever the proclivity was, and you want to now go back to Egypt. So that I'm now putting in my rebuke. But I'm disguising it a bit, because I can't talk overtly like I do with you bowing down to the calf. That I can say openly, because nobody can deny the fact that that event took place. So in an overt commission of sin, so Moses can speak openly. But in something which people might deny the gravity of the sin, so he suggests it in a very subtle hint. And he throws in a little contradiction. And he says, and there Aaron died. What do you mean Aaron died there? The Jews have to stop and say, no, he died in Hor Hor, in Mount Hor. But when they ponder about why they got to Moserah, it was due to Aaron's death. And then their whatever weaknesses that produced in them that they gave in, poor emotions. So you see that somebody wanted to suggest that the Torah must have two authors. If in one verse it says that Aaron died in Mount Hor, and another verse it says that he died in Moserah. Oh, therefore, the Torah must have two authors, and therefore, the Torah is not true. So the other person is jumping the gun because he doesn't understand how the Torah is written and how things are put in, and there are apparent contradictions that are meant to be there in order to drive your thinking. When it talks in another place about how the Jews travel from one place to another, it's using names of places, but it references to the status of the people at the place. And Maimonides talks about this in The Guide for the Perplexed. That they kept on going, and they accelerated in higher, higher levels as they progressed. So they give names to places that allude to that. So there's nothing in the Torah which is superfluous. And Maimonides says this openly. He says that just like it says in the Torah, I am God, I am one, that is no more important than the fact that it says, and the name of a certain person was this. Don't think that just because it's telling you about a name of a person, that there's no significance to this. There must be something here that's very important. Otherwise, God's just not recounting names of people in the Torah. So as well here, we apply this here, and we see that every word we talk about, how it started out by saying, "Give ear, heavens and earth." What does it talk about heavens and earth? And it says, "God speaks, and I've made children great and high, but they sinned against me." So every element over here, there's something to really to draw it out. And again, we can't spend the year and a day on every puzzle. We have to, you know, have to progress to see how the whole story develops. But at the same time, we have to strike a balance where we're sensitive to the amount of knowledge that's being communicated here. I mean, this is God's knowledge communicated by man. And we have to look at it with that humility and we have to be careful and try to strive to look at what the commentators say. Okay, that was a long monologue there. Let me pause here and see if there's any comments or questions you have. I know it's getting late. You have to the class shortly.
So I just want to make sure, Rabbi, that I understand that the reason that other reference was given to Aaron's death is to cause the people to say, no, wait a second, that's not correct, and get them engaged in thinking about the issues surrounding that?
You mean this specific verse where it says that you don't even know, the animals know more than you do?
No, back on your thing about Aaron's death being in two places.
Yes, he uses a contradiction which makes the person stop and think.
Okay.
And tries to make them, because if you just come right out and say things sometimes, if people aren't ready for it, they'll dismiss it. But if you engage the mind by creating a contradiction, now the person has to stop and think, 1 minute. That's not true. Now the mind is all of a sudden engaged, and now that can give an opening to the person's. Once the mind is now brought into the equation, now they could hopefully use that active thinking process, and it'll flow over into the rest of the events that took place at Moserah, and then they'll think, that's what Moses is alluding to.
Got it.
But if you just make a statement, then a person's defenses go up. The mind is not going to be engaged. It's just the emotions. But it was if that's what Moses did. Again, I don't know for sure. You know, I could only suggest that it is something which I think would work. that if a person wants to get a person to do a little introspection, so say something which causes the mind to start thinking, create a contradiction, and the mind will start thinking, whoa, is that true? And once they start pondering that, hopefully their thinking will spill over to all aspects of that event, and then maybe they can come around. But it gives a great, because this was before I heard this question, I never really noticed this before. So I thank the person for bringing up the question, because it brought to me, it gave me an insight into another method by which Moses is teaching the Jews, by putting in apparent contradictions. That's an amazing move. That's a very clever maneuver in terms of getting a person to think and to ponder something. So if we come away with something from today, that's one thing in terms of how our leaders had worked in a good way, very divisively, to get us back on the right track. And also about King Solomon's wisdom in those few cases that we discussed, how he was able to determine what emotion here, what button I have to push in order to resolve the issue. In one issue, I want to motivate the procrastinator. So he's motivated to procrastinate verbally because he needs social approval. I'll withdraw my approval, and then that will force him to gain the approval, and then he'll say, no, I'm doing it now. Look, approve of me. So I'll get the procrastinator to work. By the case of the two women, he knew already, even before, right after they finished talking, he knew who was guilty and who was innocent. But he knew that his court would not be able to see that. So he did something in order to bring out what those motivations were. And then the people were amazed at the fact that he was able to elicit a response that proved without a shadow of a doubt who was innocent and who was guilty. Because normally in the court, a lot of time you're just relying on the judge's decision, and people in the court don't really see clearly why he made that decision. But the best type of a verdict is one which shows without a shadow of a doubt that the verdict is absolutely the right verdict. And that's what he achieved. And that is the best type.
Your conference will expire in 10 minutes.
Oops.
All right, go ahead.
All right, so why don't we'll wrap it up here. Let's just, I'll pause one more second, see if there's any other questions you guys have.
Rabbi, there's only one question I have, and maybe it's because, I won't go into the because. The question that I have is, wouldn't it be easy for one of the Jews there to say, well, it's easy for the donkey and the ox because they're sort of programmed. They weren't given free choice. And it's the free choice and our Yetzer Hara that complicates things.
Yeah.
So to me, I'd say, why are you comparing us to an ox and a donkey when there isn't any comparison?
What do you mean? It's just the opposite. We have more than them. We're an ox and a donkey plus. We've got what they've got, plus we've got intelligence. It's a fortiori argument, a kal vachomer, as we say, that if this, then certainly that. If you can lift up a 10-pound weight, certainly you can lift up a 1-pound weight. So if an animal that's bereft of intelligence has some sort of a recognition of its master, certainly an animal with intelligence should certainly have recognition.
I see.
Okay. All right. So I guess we'll wrap it up here. We'll pick up from verse 4 next week.
Okay.
All right. And I'll pop you an email as to where this will be online. We had a little difficulty getting the sound working properly. I'm hoping that the sound is. We have Aurora is joining us from Italy here. So let me just ask her, Aurora, is the sound okay? I see that you had a comment there about the real mother will be more terrified. That's true. She made a comment about when we were talking about King Solomon. So I just want to ask her, because she's online right now, I want to see if the video, or actually the audio, picked up okay. Yehudit in, I guess, that's Georgia. How was the sound for you? Was the sound loud enough? And Aurora, also, if you could just type in, let me know. This way we can see if the settings are okay. So this way the recorded class will be good. If not, we'll have to investigate what the problem is if it's not loud enough. Let me see if they type something on the screen here. All right, but Cal and Doug, I know you got to go to the class, so thanks a lot. And we'll pick up 11:15 next Sunday. I'm just going to wait here and see.
But Rabbi, thank you so much. This was wonderful.
My pleasure. I'm glad you enjoyed.
Yeah, we appreciate it.
Yep.
Great.
Have a good week.
Okay, you too.
Thanks.
Take care.
Bye. Take care.
All right, so the sound was not too good, you're saying, Yehudit. All right, we'll have to work on the sound over here for next week and see if we can figure out what the issue was. Okay, so Aurora, oh, the audio is okay. Okay. All right, well, I see the sound level here is not as high as it should be, so we'll work on that and try to make sure it's good the next time. Okay, so I'm going to wish everybody a good day. Any questions, feel free to type them, by email, send it to us. And we'll pick up next week at the same time, 11:15 a.m. That's U.S. Eastern Standard Time. Okay, have a good day to everybody.